From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now, and I'm broadcasting today from South Carolina Public Radio in Columbia. Tomorrow, voters throughout the state will head to the polls to cast their ballots in the first and the South primary, which will be a critical test of Black support for candidates. A new poll from Monmouth University puts former Vice President Joe Biden in the lead with 36% of voters, followed by 16% for Senator Bernie Sanders and billionaire Tom Steyer polling at 15%. The other candidates don't break double digits, and they're nowhere near the 15% threshold for earning delegates. South Carolina has 54 pledged delegates up for grabs. Let's talk more about this with our reporter roundtable. Meg Kennard is national politics reporter for the Associated Press, and NPR's Juana Summers also joins us in studio. Welcome to Here and Now, ladies.
Good to be with you.
Thank you.
Well, let's talk about Biden first. Of course, this poll is not necessarily surprising. We know he has a long history with South Carolina. Is that a good indicator of how well he'll do on Saturday? What do you think, Juana?
I think it is a great indicator. We just saw former Vice President Biden pick up a key endorsement here from South Carolina's own Jim Clyburn, who is seen as a kingmaker in the state. I've been on the road with a number of candidates over the last few days, and I've been surprised by how many people were either waiting to hear what Jim Clyburn would say, or after the endorsement happened, were saying that it was actually something that was figuring into how they make their decision. Mm-hmm. A lot of voters here are still figuring out who they'll support, even though we're just a day away.
Yeah, I was surprised by that, too. A lot of voters that we spoke with said the same thing. Meg, I mean, do you feel that there needs to be this big enough lead? How much would Biden have to lead in this primary in order to propel him into Super Tuesday?
Members of his team and people in his orbit who may not necessarily be on the campaign itself are telling me they really want to see a strong double-digit victory on Saturday. It's not that they're necessarily worried that Biden isn't going to win, but they see if he has a two-digit win, that gives him the strength that he's going to need to get into these Super Tuesday contests strongly. His candidacy has been, you know, kind of having an issue over the past couple of contests, but South Carolina is a place where he feels very comfortable. And if he comes out of Saturday with something in the 10 to 15% range, that's what they tell me they feel is going to be a good standing for him to go into Tuesday.
Someone else who's doing pretty well here in South Carolina is Tom Steyer. We spoke with him yesterday. He's coming in third in this poll. I asked why he's so focused on South Carolina. Let's play a clip.
South Carolina is a state which reflects the diversity of the Democratic Party. It has a heavy proportion of African-American voters. It's got a lot of Latino voters. The Democratic Party is a big tent with a lot of racial and ethnic diversity.
Juana, we know that he spent a lot of money in this state. He's really kind of putting all of his eggs in this state. Are you surprised by how well he's polling with Black voters?
I am actually not surprised. Meg and I have both spent a lot of time here on the road with Tom Steyer. He has been coming to the state not for weeks and months, but for years, forging connections with Black voters. A lot of folks that I spoke to, I've been following him all week, have known him from his work with Need to Impeach, the advocacy group he launched, or from Next Gen America. So he, too, is a familiar figure here. But it shouldn't be lost on folks. He has spent $17 million on broadcast ads here. Everybody I talk to has gotten a Tom Steyer mailer. Some people say they are getting them every day. He is making an aggressive play specifically for Black voters here and knows how important they are.
Yeah, you know, we also talked with Congressman Jim Clyburn earlier this week. One thing that he talked about with us that he was concerned about, though, is something that he thinks about regarding the fracturing of the Democratic Party. So while Biden might be doing well here and he may do well tomorrow, overall, thinking about how maybe Bernie Sanders will do in some of the other states has him really concerned. Let's listen.
I know how this country will react to certain people. And I may be wrong about this. But if he were to get the nomination.
Senator Sanders.
Yes. I hope I'm wrong. I just don't think I am.
And Meg, to add a little more context to that, he referenced many times what happened in 1972 with the presidential contest between Richard Nixon and George McGovern. And in the end, McGovern only won one state. Do you see the similarities here?
I think that what we're hearing from Majority Whip Clyburn is something that a lot of figures within the establishment part of the Democratic Party are voicing. And I think what he's worried about and what some of them are, too, is the down-ballot implications that a top-of-the-ticket Bernie Sanders fixture could have. He's thinking about House races. He's thinking about Senate races. He's thinking about that overall balance of power in Washington that right now is tending GOP, but they would really like to see some resurgency within the Democratic Party. So I think that that is a concern that I am hearing from people. I think one thing to consider here in South Carolina, this is a place where Bernie Sanders is also incredibly well known. Mm. And he obviously campaigned in 2016, but he's also maintained somewhat of an infrastructure here. Our revolution has continued to be active in the absence of his campaign. So while we may not see him come with a victory on Saturday, that may very well go to Joe Biden, a strong standing and a strong finish by Bernie Sanders, he's obviously got some other wins under his belt already, that's going to give him strength going into Super Tuesday, and we're going to continue to hear people like Jim Clyburn saying what he told you.
We are also expecting to see President Trump here. He will hold a rally in North Charleston today ahead of tomorrow's primary. He did the same in Las Vegas the day before the Nevada caucuses. South Carolina, we're talking a lot about the Democratic primary, but it's a very red state. And there's a contingent of folks called the Operation Chaos Group who have said they plan to vote for Bernie Sanders to manipulate what comes out of here. Juana, do you think that they will be successful in that?
I think that in order for them to be successful, they would have to be a whole lot of them. If things go the way of the polls, where Joe Biden has a double-digit lead right now, it would take a lot of folks to come in and do that, to muck with the primary process, to elevate Bernie Sanders. But to your point, this is an incredibly red state. And I've talked to some voters here who make the point that for them, the economy looks good. The president is very popular. Mm-hmm. Why should they consider any of these Democrats?
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk a little bit more about Super Tuesday, which is just days away. A new poll from UC Berkeley finds Senator Bernie Sanders is taking a commanding lead against his nearest rival by 2-1 in California. And then there's also this WBUR poll out of Massachusetts that shows Sanders in the lead with 25% of the vote and Senator Warren trailing just 17% in her own state. How much do you think Senator Sanders' dominance in some of those Super Tuesday states and California specifically will impact the overall race for this nomination? Meg.
California, as we well know, is a very delegate-rich place. So whoever comes away from California with a big victory is going to have a lot of delegate numbers to back them up. So while we've seen these other early voting contests happen, South Carolina is going to do whatever South Carolina is going to do tomorrow. But I think that once we get through to Super Tuesday and all of these campaigns that are doing delegate math and really looking at how that all shapes up in terms of who gets the nomination, we very well could be seeing some strength coming in from Bernie Sanders, who even here in South Carolina, a place where most people do not expect him to win, has been having massive rallies with thousands of people. And we're most certainly going to see those continuing to happen.
Juana, you're shaking your head yes.
I am. We're going to see a third of the delegates on Super Tuesday. So California is a huge springboard. The theory of the case from the Sanders campaign and those in his orbit that I've spoken to is if they do well in South Carolina or do well in South Carolina, go on to Super Tuesday, do very well in California, the math will be on their side. And with so many moderate candidates who are vying to stop Bernie Sanders, they'll split the delegates and his advantage will be almost numerically unstoppable.
Hmm. I want to ask you about Elizabeth Warren, something that we just learned, that an unknown super PAC supporting Warren is making a $9 million ad buy in California, Texas, and Massachusetts, all states voting next Tuesday, as we've been talking about. She's also a candidate who has criticized other candidates for getting help from super PACs. How does she level with this? I want to know your thoughts, Juana.
I think we've seen in the last couple of minutes as well that she is now calling on that super PAC to release the names of its donors after coming under some criticism for seeming to have changed her mind, changed course on this. It's not clear to me whether the super PAC will actually do so. My bet is no. I don't have my phone in front of me. But I do think this is something that a number of her rivals, should she continue on in the race, should she continue to do well, they're going to start pointing to, because she did throw down this challenge of saying none of us should be taking this money and now that none of us should be getting the support of this money, even though they cannot technically direct that those funds.
Yep.
But now she is benefiting from a system that she herself has criticized.
Yeah, Meg.
I would absolutely agree with that. It's going to be very tough if the super PAC doesn't agree to release that information. It's going to make a very difficult situation for Senator Warren, given how adamant she was, particularly in the very early portions of this conversation. contest, how there needs to be transparency, how fundraisers need to be open. I think we all remember the wine cave moment that happened in one of the debates.
Yep.
So that is going to put her in a tough spot, but she also has to be cognizant of the fact that at this point, it looks like she could probably use that help.
That's NPR's Juana Summers and Meg Kinnard. I know both of you all have a very busy day ahead of you and day tomorrow. Meg is the national politics reporter for the Associated Press, and Juana Summers is with NPR. Thank you both for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Felix Contreras from NPR Music's Alt Latino podcast. As part of our Black History Month coverage, we take a look at the Afro-Latin root of reggaeton and its rise over the last decade to become one of the most listened to musical genres on the planet. To check it out, download Alt Latino from wherever you get your podcasts.
We are keeping an eye on the stock market today. There was another big drop over coronavirus fears. At one point, down over 700 points. The outbreak is also raising a lot of questions about how the law and public health intersect. A Chinese man who tested positive for COVID-19 was charged today in Singapore along with his wife. They're accused of giving false information to the government about where they'd been traveling and who they might have exposed. Also, two people in Hong Kong were charged last week for violating a quarantine. These legal issues are likely to spread as more cases are confirmed around the globe, including here in the United States. Scott Burris is director of the Center for Public Health Law Research at Temple University's Beasley School of Law, and he joins us now. Scott, welcome.
Hi.
And there have been hundreds of Americans now who were exposed to coronavirus abroad, who have been put under mandatory quarantine at military bases in California and in Texas. But how broad are the government's powers to force people into a quarantine like that?
Well, I think we can keep it simple and say that the government can use quarantine as long as there's a reasonable basis to believe it will do some good.
So very broad powers, you're saying?
Well, the problem with quarantine is it's essentially phase one of the response to a disease like this. Once you have community spread and you have hundreds or thousands of people you don't know about, as we're starting to see in the U.S., we're seeing in Italy and other places like that, quarantine doesn't work. You're just grabbing a few people that you know about and trying to control them, and pretty soon you don't have the resources to do that properly. And meanwhile, the disease is spreading anyway. So as the president of Singapore said a few days ago, the challenge for governments now is to move from trying to stop the spread through grabbing a few people and start to move towards dealing with an epidemic that's going to spread to a big chunk of the population and figure out how you reduce that rate as much as possible, as much as reasonably possible, and how you deal with the sick people.
And just a few nuts and bolts questions here. What government agency actually determines whether or not it's going to force people into a quarantine?
Well, in America, public health is primarily centered at the state and local level. CDC has authority at the border, and the CDC has authority to try and stop interstate transit. Once the outbreak is bad, quarantine has no point. It's not going to do any good. What you're going to see instead is self-isolation on a fairly large scale. Mm-hmm. You know, you're already going to see this in other countries, schools shutting down, businesses shutting down, conferences being canceled. And then you have a whole other set of problems. For example, what happens when you're shutting down your cafes and your restaurants and, you know, your schools and institutions that employ people who work from paycheck to paycheck?
Right.
You know, after 2 weeks and they haven't get a paycheck, how are they going to eat?
What recourse would they have?
Well, at the moment, they have no recourse. That's something that government should be focusing on now and companies should be focusing on. We ought to see our big, you know, corporations and gig economy type operations promising that they'll pay sick leave voluntarily to people who have to stop working because of this virus. We should see the government talking about emergency unemployment benefits. And, you know, potentially we're going to have to start talking about food aid if this goes on for 3 or 4 weeks, because there are people who run out of money. We're going to have a huge surge of need for our hospitals. There are going to be some very sick people. We don't want to have people who are mildly ill and afraid clogging the emergency room. So we got to think about how we mobilize the primary care system and all those rapid clinics to be ready to help people and communicate to them about the fact that they're probably not going to get too sick from this virus and what they should do.
And we haven't really seen a lot of this in the past. I understand that some regulations around quarantines and the like changed after the 2014 Ebola outbreak. But are there lessons that we could learn from things that we have seen in the past as it relates to public health outbreaks?
Well, we're going back to the Spanish flu. That's the closest analogy to what we have today. You know, we saw massive disruption to daily life and people essentially hiding out in their homes, you know, the economy grinding to a halt, huge demand on healthcare systems. That's where we should look. And that's why I say our big issue now is going to be at least getting ready. Maybe we'll be lucky and this won't spread that rapidly. We'll get a vaccine. But right now, the imperative is to prepare to make sure that we have an effective response that's also not putting a huge burden on the poorest people among us.
Do you think the United States could ever legally take drastic measures like the ones that we've already seen in China, where the government locks down entire cities and essentially prevents millions of people from moving around?
Well, again, the government has, and has always had in public health, extreme emergency powers. It's just like imagining, you know, if you have a hurricane or a flood and people are ordered to leave, you know, a whole part of the state. Sure, they can do it, you know, if it's necessary. But where courts step in and have always stepped in for the last 100 years or so in public health law is when you have something that's driven by politics or public fear that isn't going to do any good. You know, China shut down lots and lots of places. It didn't stop the spread. Pretty much when you start thinking about shutting down California, it's already in Nevada. And when you try and shut down Nevada, it's moved on to North Dakota and so on. It's just not an effective measure. And I think in that case, when you start to see the kinds of disruptions and harm it would cause, courts might step in. Remember, if you're not shipping food, if you're not shipping parts for manufacturing and all that sort of stuff, then you start to have the economy grind to a halt. And that's dangerous to health, too.
That's Scott Burris, professor and director of the Center for Public Health Law Research at Temple University's Beasley School of Law, giving us lots to think about. Professor, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Just over the border from New York in the city of Cornwall, Canada, the Canadian government is holding 129 people who were taken off the Diamond Princess cruise ship while it was docked in Yokohama, Japan. They are also being monitored for the virus. Julia Ritchie from North Country Public Radio has the report.
It's a slightly overcast kind of day when I pull up to the sprawling brick nav center in Cornwall, Canada.
So there are yellow barriers up outside of the nav center right now, where I'm walking up to a few cars parked up by the gate with a lot of no trespassing signs. You can see everyone who's outside of a car kind of milling about the front have masks on over their face.
Inside the hotel and conference center, 129 Canadians are being held in quarantine for 14 days in an isolated wing. They were passengers aboard the Diamond Princess cruise liner that saw nearly 700 infections from coronavirus spread throughout the ship. Four of those people have since died from the illness. In the week since they arrived, none of the Canadians in Cornwall have tested positive for the virus, a point Canada's Chief Public Health Officer Theresa Tam underlined in a conference call with reporters.
Canadians who were evacuated from the Diamond Princess cruise ship in Japan are now settled into their accommodations in a secure wing of the NAF Center in Cornwall, or are doing well and are free of coronavirus symptoms.
Yet it's the decision to house the cruise ship passengers in Cornwall that has divided some in the city of 47,000 on the St. Lawrence River. Canada's Global Affairs Office announced the arrangement in a short press release 2 weeks ago before informing local officials.
That took pretty much everybody by surprise.
Hugo Rodriguez is managing editor of the local paper, The Standard Freeholder. He says the lack of coordination with local officials sent many residents scrambling for more information.
It left a vacuum. And into the vacuum stepped the people with legitimate concerns. And then, of course, in this day and age of social media, it allowed those people who were driven by fear to peddle in misinformation.
Rodriguez says the bulk of those comments came from local detractors, questioning whether the passengers were really symptom-free. Rodriguez says he also took a call from a woman who was convinced the cruise ship, currently in Japan, would be docked on the banks of the St. Lawrence River. It's that kind of misinformation that Mayor Bernadette Clement has been battling in the weeks since the NAV Center went into lockdown. Because the facility is privately operated, the Canadian government did not seek the city's permission to arrange the transfer of passengers from a military base to Cornwall. Clement says that was a mistake.
We're welcoming people. We are, and we're very resilient. But we need to be more involved in this kind of decision-making, especially when it has an impact on the community.
Clement has done Facebook Live videos, hosted a press conference with health officials, and is now receiving daily briefings about what's going on at the NAV Center.
And it's, I would say, much better. The international context, though, is getting scarier.
And that has some Cornwall residents concerned. Even though none of the quarantine passengers are sick, resident Bonnie Rutley is still worried about the spread of coronavirus in her community. Right now, there are 13 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Canada, six of them in Ontario.
What can you do? There's nothing that you can do. We have no say. They did it.
Do you feel like they're communicating well enough with the public about what's going on?
No.
Retiree Cheryl Fisher says the patients shouldn't be here in the first place.
To me, they shouldn't be doing it at all when there's already none in Cornwall. Why bring it in, take the chance that they're bringing it in?
It's a risk Fisher doesn't think is worth taking in a town with a population that skews slightly older. Many of the quarantine passengers are also older, which is why health officials are taking extra precautions monitoring them. But if all goes according to plan, at the end of next week, after nearly a month holed up in either a cabin or a hotel room, the former cruise ship passengers will finally be free to go home. For Here and Now, I'm Julia Ritchie, reporting from Cornwall, Ontario.
Our planet has a new mini moon. That's one way to refer to the near-Earth asteroid that has been orbiting the planet since 2017. Astronomers first observed it earlier this month, giving the asteroid the provisional name 2020 CD3. We're joined now by one of those astronomers. Eric Christensen is director of the Catalina Sky Survey, a NASA-funded near-Earth asteroid search team based at the University of Arizona's Lunar and Planetary Laboratory. Eric, welcome. Nice find.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on the show.
So, but what is this thing and what is it doing in Earth's orbit?
Well, we believe that this is a natural asteroid that became temporarily captured by the Earth-Moon system and has maybe been orbiting us for a couple of years and is now on its way back out into heliocentric space.
So it's leaving the orbit of Earth.
It's returning to the sun-centered orbit from which it came.
So it's small. It's about 12 feet across. How are you able to find something so tiny?
Well, we use telescopes to look for objects like this. We're actually tasked with finding larger objects on the order of 100 meters in diameter that might pose a hazard to Earth or human populations. However, our telescopes are powerful enough that they can also capture nearby small objects.
And your job is to make sure asteroids don't hit the Earth. So what's the risk? I mean, was there ever a chance this was going to hit the Earth, or maybe even could it collide with the moon?
There is a chance. In fact, this object has a fairly elevated risk of impact with the Earth, about a 3% chance over the next 100 years currently.
Okay. So and how is it possible that this asteroid, you know, didn't just zoom by Earth, that it actually got sucked up into its orbit?
Yeah, so this asteroid started in a heliocentric orbit, orbiting the sun. However, this object has evolved into a very Earth-like orbit. And so when it approached the Earth, it was doing so very slowly and has been making a fairly chaotic orbit around the Earth for a couple of years now, influenced by both the Earth's gravity, the sun's gravity, the moon's gravity. That's why these orbits are not stable on long timescales. They tend to come in, they're captured, and then they leave.
And I take it it's pretty rare.
Well, we believe that there's a population of temporarily captured objects that are always coming and going. Most of the predicted temporarily captured objects are a meter or smaller. So this is being a few meters in diameter is maybe one of the larger objects, which is partly why we were able to detect it.
I know the press, people like me, are like happy and excited to say, oh, the Earth has a new moon. Do you cringe when we say that? I mean, is that accurate?
I think the technically appropriate term is temporarily captured object, but like many names in science, that's really boring. And mini moon is something that somebody can relate to a little more. So yes, we can call it a mini moon, provided it is shown to be a natural asteroid rather than some recaptured piece of space debris.
Uh-huh. And by the way, it's about the size of a car, we said. So I was wondering if anyone has proven that this is not the Tesla that Elon Musk shot out into space.
I think we can conclusively say it is not. We actually observed the Tesla when it was in space. We know its orbit fairly well. It is unlikely to be recaptured into a temporarily captured orbit.
All right. Well, you heard it here first. That's Eric Christensen, director of the Catalina Sky Survey at the University of Arizona in Tucson. Eric, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg has been a frontrunner so far in the Democratic presidential primary contest. But here in South Carolina, we may be telling a different story after tomorrow. According to several polls, Buttigieg has around 4% support among Black Democratic voters here. There are lots of theories about why. Buttigieg is young. He also hasn't had a long political career. But one roadblock we've heard a lot about, at least early on in the contest, is Buttigieg's identity as a gay man. This despite a new poll from Winthrop University that shows 79% of Black American voters don't care if a candidate is gay. I talked with couple Gerald McNair and his partner David Alexander here in Columbia, who have different outlooks on the topic. For Gerald, he thinks it's overblown that Black people are not supporting Buttigieg because of his gay identity.
Information is being trickled so fast, it's so hard to catch up of how African Americans feel about a certain gay people, because you're constantly fighting against the media who is perpetuating it out there. We cannot change that narrative, so it's kind of a hard thing to do.
He says the media has perpetuated that stereotype. But his partner, David Alexander, who is an advocate for HIV and AIDS education here in Columbia, believes there is a lingering stigma, specifically in the South and in the Bible Belt, around LGBTQ issues, and that can't be overlooked.
In the Black community, there's one thing that we need to come to grips with, and it's not only just the individuals of being gay, but also there is the whole idea of HIV that plays into the stereotypic part and the stigma of the Black community. We don't talk about HIV in our community, and we suffer a great deal within our community where people are living with HIV. And the Black church haven't been able to come to grips to deal with their own children and their own community to address that issue. There's so much stigma within our community about that alone. So we have to get past that in order to accept something else. Pete Buttigieg is a gay candidate, but more than that, you know, it's like anyone else. You have to know what he's all about. There are personal issues that I have myself with Pete Buttigieg, but it has nothing to do with his sexuality. I want to know what he can do for me. I'm not trying to figure out that other stuff in his life. I'm trying to figure him out as a politician. Will he be good for our community? Will he be assistance in our community? Will he help the stigma in our community? Will he help in the epidemic of HIV in our community? My concern. Now, any other politician, why are you here? Why do you want my vote?
That was David Alexander and Gerald McNair, a couple here in Columbia, South Carolina, giving us insights into the popularity of presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg among Black voters here. South Carolina Public Radio's Thalisha Eady joins us now to talk about some of the other issues local voters are also thinking about this election season. Welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So, Thalisha, I want to start off with health care. We've been talking with voters across the state, and that seems to be the most urgent issue for a lot of people. What are you hearing from people about their insurance and how health care is playing into this primary contest?
I definitely agree. You know, since covering the South Carolina leg of this 2020 race, I've talked with a lot of people. And when I asked them, what's your number one concern? Always, it was health care, especially early on in this process. There are two conversations I had with voters this past summer that's really stuck with me during this process. I spoke with an African-American man, registered Democrat, living in a rural part of South Carolina, Warrensville, South Carolina, in Aiken County. And then I spoke with a Caucasian man, registered Republican, who lives in Chapin in Lexington County. They were both at the Clyburn Fish Fry this past summer. And so we we'll start with our Chapin resident. He was at the fish fry with his two children, and he said that he was there, registered Republican, was there for hope. And he mentioned that he felt that our health care system was a disaster and that people were working longer because they needed coverage. But because people were working longer, they weren't freeing up jobs for younger people like his children that were there, and they were concerned about that. And so now we kind of skip over to our rural resident from Aiken County, and he was in a wheelchair connected to a breathing tank, so visibly in need of medical care. Before arriving at the fish fry, he had just came back from a conversation with with Kamala Harris. She was talking with people about access and transportation to hospitals for people living with HIV and AIDS and who don't have who have that barrier. They can't easily get there because, in part, they live in a rural part of the state. And so this guy shares with me that had he not been a veteran, he would be, and I'm using his words, messed up. Mm-hmm. And then he also shared that some of his friends who have passed on already were not as fortunate as he was. And those barriers kept them from living and maintaining their health, and they eventually expired. Mm-hmm. Those two conversations really do stick with me because they focus on the smaller subtopics within the larger topic of healthcare and how it impacts different people throughout the state. Yeah. And there are other conversations as well. When talking with people here in Richland County, there's a zip code. There's an area where there is the it's one of the areas that leads in diabetes related amputations because people don't have the health care. They don't have the means to continue seeing their doctor to learn how they can maintain their health.
In fact, here in South Carolina, there's a high percentage of folks who are underinsured or have no health insurance at all. They don't have access to private health insurance. Mm-hmm. You know, and with that, a lot of folks who are working part time jobs or jobs where they're not making minimum wage. Mm-hmm. We actually met some folks who say that this should be a topic worth prioritizing. One person we spoke with works at a McDonald's and is striking for higher minimum wage. Let's listen.
My name is Deja Davis. I was born and raised in Charleston. I'm 19 years old. I work at McDonald's, 230 Spring Street. I'm a cashier. It's a struggle. We have to have... If it wasn't for a little government assistance, we wouldn't have clothes on our back, shoes on our feet, our roof over our head. I have a big responsibility, and I'm helping my mom pay her bills too. And we both work at fast food restaurants. Living check to check is a very big struggle for us.
Felicia, this is all interconnected.
Absolutely.
We're talking about health insurance being underinsured and then people fighting for minimum wage. What are you hearing about this minimum wage fight?
The exact same story. Not that long ago, there was a rally at the State House here in Columbia, and I spoke with residents, voters, and minimum wage workers there. It's like the story is like the clip we just heard came from the person I talked 2 months ago at the State House. It's the same story. Like health care, this minimum wage conversation, raising the minimum wage, is another big topic that you hear on the ground. But unlike health care, it's not really – you don't really hear it too much, especially on the national scene or being covered in the news a lot. But what we do know is that here in South Carolina, minimum wage is just $7.25 an hour, and that was mandated by the federal government back in 2008. And if you did the math, Tanya, you know, working 40 hours a week – all 52 weeks of the year at $7.25 an hour. That's $15,000. That's before taxes. Before taxes. And so, just like you said, it's all connected. That's a little bit of money, and people have to pay their rent or pay their mortgage or buy medicine or put gas in their vehicles to drive, especially if they're in a rural area, to drive longer distances. We talked about health care. I'm sure your listeners know that, you know, South Carolina is one of the states that have seen rural hospital closures four in the state. Mm-hmm. So, again, creating that barrier, increasing, stretching that distance for people to get to medical help. So it's again, you hear the stories over and over again, and they're all connected.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the races. We've been talking a lot about the presidential contest, but I want to look down the ballot now at Senator Lindsey Graham. He's a three-term senator and staunch Trump supporter. He's being challenged by Democrat Jamie Harrison, and Harrison looks like the inevitable primary winner. He has some substantial momentum, but how much of a chance does he have against Graham, who has big name recognition and support in this state?
You know, I think we can answer questions like that now with the phrase, anything can happen.
Anything can happen, right?
And I say that because over the past few years, we have seen just about anything happen in this political climate. And so I really do see that. I don't know. What we do know is that South Carolina is a red state, a very red state. Lindsey Graham has big name recognition. He's been in office for a really long time. But like you said, Jamie Harrison, he is really hitting the ground. He has great support. And also, you know, he's been hitting social media really, really well, getting his name out there.
That's South Carolina Public Radio, Felicia Eady. So nice talking with you. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely.
A court in the United Kingdom has ruled that plans for a third runway at London's Heathrow Airport are illegal because they don't address the impact of climate change. The ruling is a first because it cites the Paris Climate Agreement, and it could influence decisions on big infrastructure projects around the world. Damian Carrington has been writing about this for The Guardian. Damian, welcome.
Hi, pleased to be here.
Good to have you. And this is an $18 billion project, this airport expansion. It's been in the works for many years now. What else did the judge say to reject it?
Well, actually, the judges were quite narrow in their verdict, in which they said that the specific thing which the government hadn't done was take account of its own climate change policies, which included the Paris Climate Change Agreement, which the UK had ratified. And because it hadn't done that, then it was illegal to have given permission for it to go ahead. So it's not the end of the story just yet. There could be an appeal from the airport itself, but it was certainly a very big blow. And I think what's important is that the climate of public opinion is also changing. You know, people are more ill-disposed towards it, which I think perhaps the judge reflected.
Did anyone lay out the argument of how damaging this would be to the climate? For example, I know that the new runway would bring up to 700 new planes every day to Heathrow.
Absolutely, yes. So there's been a long history of this, and so it was first proposed, you know, probably almost 20 years ago, and there's been a lot of back and forth and debate and estimates and reports and reviews and so on about the impact. But it's very clear that you know, passenger numbers would go up from something like 80 million to 130 million a year. Heathrow's already Europe's busiest airport, so there would clearly be an impact in terms of increased emissions of CO2. Where the debate comes is, you know, to what extent can an increase in CO2 from aviation be accommodated alongside all the other reductions that need to happen across society to reach net zero, say, by 2050.
Well, and it's not just the UK. I mean, many, many other countries around the world have pledged to reduce their carbon emissions. They've signed on to the Paris deal. Is there a sense there that environmental groups will start to make these types of legal arguments for other projects around the world?
Yeah, I think so. So certainly there are plenty of legal cases being taken against fossil fuel infrastructure and also, you know, roads, airports, power stations, that kind of thing. What was interesting about the verdict around Heathrow, it was the first time for a major infrastructure project that the Paris Climate Change Accord had been cited and as a reason for it not to go ahead, at least in its current form. And I think that has galvanized people in terms of being able to point at a, you know, clear international treaty, which may help their cause. Of course, in the United States, we'll see what happens, because as it stands, the United States is due to leave the Paris Treaty on about the day of the forthcoming presidential election.
And of course, it'll depend on who wins in 2020. We'll see if that continues to matter in the United States. But look, I'm sure there are plenty of people there in London who believe that this project should get done, that it's important for the economy, especially, you know, post-Brexit, when the UK is looking to boost its international profile. What are they saying?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the biggest proponent, of course, is the chief executive of Heathrow itself, who said no third runway, no global Britain. It's as simple as that. So, of course, you know, there are many people who think that the economic side of the third runway could be, you know, a big benefit for Britain and link it to more parts of the world, which may be necessary or useful after Brexit. But I think, again, this is one of the reasons why I think the case or the verdict at Heathrow will be seen as a seminal moment, was that, you know, these two things were weighed up. On the one hand, you've got, you know, the kind of short-term economic benefit, and on the long term, you've got this threat of the climate emergency and all the damage that that would do to the world that we live in. And this is one of the rare occasions where, you know, care for the climate took precedence.
Hmm. And your Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, I guess has not been a fan of the expansion over the years. Here he is in 2015, when he was then the mayor of London. He famously said this.
I will lie down with you in front of those bulldozers and stop the building, stop the construction of that third runway. Yes.
Now he is the Prime Minister. He's got a lot more power. So what's next? I mean, is the government going to try to appeal this at all?
No. So interestingly, the government said that it wouldn't appeal the verdict. It said that the third runway in Heathrow has to be a privately funded project, and therefore the airport itself will have to pursue the legal process. What's interesting, of course, about Boris Johnson is that from that clip that you played, after that, rather, he became an MP for a constituency in the west of London, which the planes fly over when they go to Heathrow. So that was part of the reason for his opposition. But I think the verdict from Heathrow case has given him a very good opportunity to sort of step back and say, hey, look, you know, the courts have decided there's a problem here. You know, who am I to get in the way? So he could probably get what he wants, which is not the third runway, without having to pay a political cost in terms of looking anti-business.
That's Damian Carrington, environmental editor for The Guardian. Thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
Welcome. Bye.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley, hosting from South Carolina Public Radio. And I want to thank all of the kind folks here, including engineer A.T. Shire, Sean Berg, and Felicia Eady. This is Here and Now.
States, including populous California and Texas, will vote on Super Tuesday after contests in Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina. Will Bernie Sanders' lead in the early states hold up? Our coverage of the race for the Democratic nomination for president continues. That's next time on Here and Now.